Outside the room, I heard the nurses talking about my husband. Her husband? First husband? I heard Drew's footsteps outside in the hall. I saw him smiling, standing outside the door. Why was he here? Why was I trapped in this room? Why had they brought him? He wasn't my husband. Outside, I heard women screaming. Who was he hurting? And then I realized who Drew was. He was every man who was cruel to women. We were the comfort women, he the Japanese soldiers. We were the wives, the ones who hid in the darkness, hiding behind concealer and false smiles. I started to scream. I needed to exit this place. Perhaps I was Alice in Wonderland, and I could shrink if I only ate the right thing. I started to chew on a piece of plastic I found that fitted on the bottom of a chair leg. Was I shrinking? Would I be able to hide? I didn't know what I would do if Drew came in. I thought of all the ways I could kill him with what was in the room. A pen to the face, a cable cord around his neck, a shattering of the vase. I remembered the moment on the balcony. I hadn't had the will to fight then, but I did now. I knew now that I could not be prey. Time split again. I was on the balcony, debating if I should leap. I was Leah, begging my son not to jump. I was Cato, looking down from the balcony ledge. I could see the oceans below me, hands lifted up as if in prayer. I thought of all the patterns in the universe. Why had I never noticed them before? I had been so blind. I was sensing something larger than myself. I was seeing the face of God. I was seeing the infinite. I remember that when we were children, Teddy asked me what it would feel like to die. He was scared, he said. I think he was 7 and I was 10. I remember I couldn't imagine not being able to use 2 hands to count my age. I remember that I told him a child's version of heaven and he smiled. I remember that we were watching the hibiscus burn bright red in the fading light. We were looking out over the gravestones, the ones that lay empty. The black marble glinted midnight blue in the setting sun. He reminded me of this a couple of years ago when he came back from his trip around the world. He didn't believe anymore, he said. He had seen all the beauty that nature had. He had climbed mountains, spent days in solitude, walking with only the wilderness around him. He had lost his faith, no matter how hard he tried to find it. He sounded regretful. He was still scared, he said. He had felt so alone. In the ward, I have a glimpse of what Teddy meant. Days in solitude, without really talking, without really feeling. But I am waiting. I keep walking, to find the morning. I think of Westbrook, my godfather. In the end, he had longed to die. He had sat by the window, his eyes closed, waiting for the night to come. His beloved wife had died first of Alzheimer's. It had taken away her memories, her identity, and left a shell behind. Death was a friend, my godfather said, and he had seen it often. It would be a place where soldiers were safe, where the young men he had fought with would stand tall, would laugh, run free. It would be a place where his daughter would be, a child, always 11. She died of cystic fibrosis, never able to fully take a breath. Death was the next adventure, he said. It was finding morning. I remember that James told me they were going to have to take me to another hospital. I was going to leave. A doctor stood by James. His arms were crossed. He was wearing silver spectacles. His voice was grave. "She's been here for 4 days, and she hasn't slept," he said to James, ignoring me. "She doesn't seem to know who she is. She isn't getting better. Each time I've spoken to her, she is still confused." What did he mean by 4 days? Each time he had spoken to me. When had we spoken? "I've never spoken to you," I said. The doctor didn't turn his head and acted as though he hadn't heard me. But then maybe I had. Dr. Jacobs. I tried to remember. I remembered being a child, drawing flowers with crayons and a man nodding his head at me. His name had been Dr. Jacobs. But I hadn't been Catherine in that version, or had I? The world was a wash of color. I could barely see anything. Where were my contacts? Where were my glasses? I didn't have my glasses. Why couldn't I see? Yes, James said gently. It's because you were trying to chew on the glass. But I can't see, I said. Maybe this was my fate, to be blinded, like my father. The world was just lights, blurred shapes of light and dark, and the people in it were figures that moved like colored shadows. Was this how my father always saw the world? Where was my engagement ring, my wedding ring? Was I not married in this version? My fingers were bare. Lane told me that I was going to be going on a roller coaster. He was strapping me onto a bed. My wrists were in restraints. I smiled at him. How sweet that he was trying to protect me from the truth. I knew the truth. I was going to be euthanized. I was leaving hell, but I had failed. I was going to be extinguished. I asked that he choose the fastest method. I want it to be quick, I said. Let's not overthink it, he said. I always depend on the kindness of strangers, I thought. That sounded familiar. Lane stepped into a vehicle. I saw that it was an ambulance. I saw the bright light of day, and I shaded my eyes. The sunlight was too bright. The air was crisp and clear, and I breathed it deeply into my lungs. I started to sing as loud as I could. Maybe Teddy would hear me. Maybe he could tell Cato about me. Cato would be too young to remember. I sang until the door closed behind me. Time was still fracturing. I caught a glimpse of the world ending, again and again, apocalyptic. I saw a version where James was Ender, the one destined to close the universe. I saw Cato die. I saw Cato live. I saw him grow up without a mother. I saw him grow up with a stepmother. I saw Cato grow up to be James. I saw James as the youngest of three sons. I saw Cato's sons. I saw them die, and then be reborn again. I saw spaceships. I saw Cylon War. I saw James fighting Cato. I saw floods. I saw Noah's Ark, the fall of the gods, of Odin's son. I saw time bend. And then, I cannot see. I'm holding my hands like binoculars to my face and calling them glasses. I remember singing in French and pulling at my clothes. I remember a gurney and Lane holding my hands as I saw beasts pacing around me. What was happening? Was I in a pound? A zoo? An ape screams at me. An owl screeches. A panther stares at me from its perch. I remember a light. A white room. Plain. I hear a phone ringing. There are no windows. Where is the light coming from? Was I going to be here for all eternity? I hear the animals outside. No, no, you can't be here. I hear shouting. I feel arms on me, hands on me, rough, and I'm being carried back into the white room. My legs are wet. Is that urine? There is liquid on the floor. There are faces in the slot of the door, concerned ones. I see Drew's face, then my father's, then a demon's, then James's, then my own. I hear screaming, coming from within. Is that me? I'm screaming. I hear James's voice shouting as though in a tunnel. I am being put into a box, a box. And then I wake up, with my hair tied in a strange way, and my breasts a network of knots. I am in a room. The lights are bright, so bright I can hear them, a noise in my head. There is a smell of chlorine and chemicals. A woman is in the room with a mop. Breasts, breasts, she shouts at me. I realize she means that I need to express. My breasts are swollen. I feel them. They're a mess of knots, red and sore to touch. Oh, I remember. I was breastfeeding. I try to think about Cato, but the thought is pushed away. The woman is slight with dark hair. She's wearing scrubs and rubber shoes. She walks me outside of my room to the hallway, where she opens a door to a shower. She strips my hospital robe and gestures to me to express milk. I stare blankly at the shower head. There is no tap. Here, here, she says, and jams a toothbrush into a divot by the shower. The water is ice cold. She presses my breasts for me, motioning to me. Breasts, she shouts. I mirror her. Change, change, she says. She hands me a bra and a pair of underwear and maternity leggings. Those are my clothes, I think. There's a jumper which I recognize as my husband's. I wonder what he's wearing. She drags a pair of large men's socks over my feet. I pad out to a bright hallway. I hear the sounds of phones, of the tapping on computer keyboards. I hear a boy's voice. "Hello, Kat." He is walking along the hallway. He nods as he walks past. I wonder how he knows my name. She walks me back to the room. Before she leaves, she hands me a pair of glasses, and suddenly the world comes into focus. I can see the room. It's plain and white concrete. There is a bed in the corner, but the sheets have been stripped. There is a window with bars at the top. There is a curtained partition. I open it and see a small bathroom, a toilet, and a metal sink. When I look at myself in the mirror, I don't recognize myself. I only see glasses. I look around the room, at the single bed, at the shelving on the side. There are stacks of jumpers, leggings, underwear, cartoon socks. I touch them, one by one, slowly. They are my clothes. I find a notebook under my pillow. It's gray with thick, pale paper. I recognize it as one of my husband's treasured ones. On the front page is his handwriting, precise and neat. There's a list of names with phone numbers, and the date, 9th February, 2018, is written at the top. The year is underlined in thick ink. So it's still 2018. There is a purple marker on the shelf. I tear out a page and I write my truths. "I am alive," I write. In Hong Kong, they believe that the spirit world is in the same realm as ours, only thinly separated, with spaces that overlap. The spirits, they watch us from their realm. If life was cut off too quickly, they yearn to reach the living. Their presence can be felt in those moments. Whether it's the wind or the call of the night, the spirits, they are here. And so, in this way, they are never separated from us. When someone passed, you would stay at night in their home. You would light candles and prepare a large feast so that the spirits could visit and help guide the deceased's soul to the other realm. You wouldn't clean up the feast. You would leave it on the table, and before you left the room, you would sprinkle the ground with white flour so that you could see the footsteps as they departed. I loved that image of the footsteps of the spirit realm. It felt true to me, in a way. How many times had I felt the linger of a memory, the yearning of a spirit, of my grandmother? My grandmother passed away alone, on a quiet morning in the summer. Towards the end, she became like paper. She didn't have the energy to stand. She lay in bed, taking sips of water, listening to the sound of the ocean. I wonder if she thought of her island home, or if she remembered being a young girl and watching the warplanes go by. My grandmother started to forget. Her memories of the past overtook the present. She cried for brothers we had never heard of. She cried for babies unborn. She cried for her mother. I hope the spirits heard her. It is visiting hour. James comes with my father this time. James says that my mother wasn't sure if she should come. I think James also wants to spare her seeing me in a mental hospital. It's the same number of guests again. Most of the cafeteria is empty. It's Emma, Mick, and me. I see Emma embracing an older man and a young woman. It must be her father and sisters, I think. She's crying. Mick is looking grave. The man who is with him stands slightly apart from Mick's wheelchair, like he doesn't want to be too close. I give James the valentine for Cato. He blinks hard and puts it in his pocket. My father is wearing his coat with the high collar, the one that I thought made him look like a general. His face is lined. He looks hesitant. His eyes are owlish. He's not wearing his glasses, but he walks deliberately, footsteps clear against the linoleum floor. I realize that in my nightmares, the footsteps I had heard, the voice I had heard in the halls, they weren't Drew's. They were his. I meet his eyes, and I wonder if they will look at me with fear or curiosity, but they are just his eyes, dark oceans, and I realize they are the color of Cato's eyes. "Hi," he says. James is holding my hand, tracing the bones in my wrist. "Hi, Appa," I say. He clears his throat, gruff, unsure. Look, he says with a sudden smile. He takes out a fountain pen from his pocket and a piece of paper. He draws quickly, surely, his eyes almost touching the paper. And I laugh. I remember this drawing from my childhood. It's a silhouette of a man smoking a pipe. The silhouette is made of numbers. The pipe with a lazy curl of smoke is a number 9. His hat is the number 3 lying on its side. Number man, I say. Yes, number man. He looks shyly proud. You kept asking your father to draw this, James says. You thought it had a hidden message. I did? I ask. I don't remember. I stare at the number man, an enigma. We sit in silence. I don't know what to say, so with my other hand, I pat my father's hand. James smiles at me, and I look at the two men sitting across from me, my past, my future. When they leave, I stand to watch them go. James walks first, leading my father. My father shakes my hand, and he walks firmly, his footsteps echoing on the floor. He seems to linger, and he turns to me with an expression on his face that looks like regret. I start to show people the photos that James gave me. Look, I say to Nona, this is my son. I practice saying this, pointing at the baby in the photo. Oh, she takes the photo from me. How precious. How old is he? She asks me. How old is he? James told me over the phone that it was Cato's 100-day celebration yesterday. They had a small celebration at my in-laws' home. He's 100 days, I say. You need to get better so you can go home to baby, she says, and nods fiercely at me. Shara is there too. She pats my shoulder and looks at me like she knows I don't recognize the baby in the photo. Don't worry, honey. You have a whole lifetime to get to know him. A whole lifetime. That seems inadequate. I've lived multiple lifetimes already. I want more than a lifetime. I want a lifetime of suspended moments. In my notebook, I draw a woman with a baby in her arms. Her hair has a rainbow in it, a prism of color. Her eyes are closed. She can't see the light. The baby is a curve in her arms, intertwined. You seem to be much better, the doctor says. It's the one from before. It's been 2 days since we've spoken. She's still looking at the clock above my shoulder. I feel much more myself, I say. Good, good, she says. We're going to work on getting you home, she says. You'll be able to leave tomorrow. We'll just have to prepare the paperwork. I feel like a window is opening. You'll get to go home to your husband. He's been very worried about you. She smiles at me. My last night in the ward. I try to sleep, but I cannot. I am thinking of my lifetimes, my memories, those loops. So now I know that when I am old, when I become like paper and start to forget, and my past becomes my present, I will cry for Teddy, a boy in corduroys who flies kites so high they touch the moon. I will cry for my father, a blind man, number man. I will cry for my mother, so beautiful, just thinking of her makes me ache. I will cry for James, my kind husband, who has conviction and a smile that could hold up the world. And I will call for Cato, my son. My grandmother used to tell me a story about one of her older brothers who lived on an island off the coast of South Korea, Dog Island, big enough for a village, and that was all. It is now an empty place. The younger generations left for the mainland, tired of the hard tides that surrounded it. My great uncle, an old man, had been married for over 40 years when he fell in love with a widow who sold sweet potatoes at the market. Every night he would go out to meet her, the now disgraced woman, and his 80-year-old father would chase after him with a stick and beat him and curse him all the way there. My great uncle would have let himself get beaten. I can picture this. He would have tried to move his shoulders so that each blow would fall more squarely on his back, because then, at the end, his ultimate punishment would have been less. My grandmother said that my great uncle would cry. Both men would cry, the cursed one and the curser. When my great uncle lay dying, he asked to see the woman. They wouldn't allow him. His wife and children stood guard over his bed, watched until he lost his last breath. There was a long funeral procession, his family carrying the box of ashes to let out at sea with the night tide. As my grandmother walked along the procession, she looked up and saw an old woman weeping in the mountains, running along the rocky path above. Following like a ghost in the traditional mourning clothes, my grandmother said, a white dress. I can understand the beauty of the story, my weeping great uncle, the ruined woman. What would her life be like after the ashes were put to sea? She had been left alone, abandoned. They both knew that their ending would not be a happy one. This does not mean that my great uncle was preparing himself for sorrow, hanging his head, waiting for the end, but that he expected it. I think, though, that my great uncle had a quiet hope, the hope of every great love story, that things will end happily ever after. It is that quiet hope that if they hurl themselves fast enough, they will come out on top. And then they realize that that is the top, to reach that pinnacle of not caring about the end, to know that the end doesn't matter. This is the happiness of the ending, to have reached the point when the moment is enough, when to love is enough. To fall fast, faster than gravity, faster than the ground can pull you back down, and find sky again, on the other side. Tamira gives me a reluctant hug. Her paperwork hasn't come through yet, which means she'll need to stay for another few days, as it's a holiday weekend. She spends her time lying in bed, screaming because of her ear infection. Mick calls her a drama queen, but I hope the doctors will get her antibiotics. Thanks for teaching me Chinese checkers, Darren says. He's leaving today, too. I can't believe you're leaving, Emma wails. She asks that I promise to keep in touch. She writes her phone number in my notebook, like we're leaving high school. Stay cool, I think. Ollie smiles at me before giving me a big hug. How much longer, I ask him. That seems a safe question to ask. He shrugs. At least another month, he says, and then he tries to laugh. Christine tells me that I can start packing. I gather my clothing, James's jumpers, my notebook and scraps of colored drawings, my beloved foam slippers. I offer to give Tamira my toothpaste, thinking she'll be pleased, but she looks annoyed. I don't want that, she says. You got any t-shirts? I shake my head. I feel sorry. As I gather my things, I think of my grandparents and James's grandparents. The ones who fled their homes with their belongings on the backs of donkeys, saying their farewells without knowing that it would be the last time, that there would be no reunion, only mystery and wondering, lives interrupted. They were suspended in the waiting, waiting desperately for the chance to meet again. I think this is why Koreans are so obsessed with time and the past. They are yearning for something pure, for something they are never sure will happen again. And yet they wait, and they treasure the waiting, the yearning, because that is all they have. And I take comfort that, even if I was not in it, there was a version of James's life where he would be happy, surrounded by so many grandchildren he couldn't keep track of them. And we would meet again, when he was 102, and I was with Cato, a newborn, and he would smile and hold my hand, and maybe he would, for a moment, recognize me. Your husband is here, they say. He's here to take you home. I have a plastic bag with my possessions. I'm wearing boots. It's been so long since I've had shoes on that I shuffle in them. I am the first to leave the ward today, they tell me. I get to go first. My husband has been waiting since early this morning. I walk the length of the hallway once more, past the glass enclosure. The nurses and doctors look up from their computers and phones and wave at me. Jeff gives me a hug. Take care of yourself, he says. Randy is waiting by the meds line. Bye, he says. See you later. I wave. I'm walking, one foot slowly in front of the other, following Christine. She opens the door. I see James on the other side. He's teary-eyed. He reaches his arms out for me. I step through the door. I don't glance behind me. This is my 1,000th step, I think. I can finally breathe. I take my first steps. After my release, James took me to a hotel overlooking the Manhattan skyline. It's close to the hospital, he said. It was unspoken, but the words hovered in the air. Just in case. We still have a few days before our flight back to London, he said. We do? I asked. Yes, our original flight, he said. We're leaving in 5 days. I had spent a total of 12 days away from Cato, 4 days in the emergency room, and 8 days at the ward. As we left the labyrinth of the brick building, I could sense the air changing, becoming sharper, clearer, and as we exited through the thick doors, each step felt magical. The cars, roads, people. It was familiar and yet new. James held my hand as he drove, and we arrived at the hotel with a lobby of copper and brass. I listened to our footsteps echoing on the tiles, to the people leaving, smiling, and chatting. Did they know that they were free? Where were they going, I wondered. The lift had mirrored walls, and I looked at my reflection unsteadily. My hair was falling down over my shoulders, tangled and unruly. Was I marked? Did I look the same? I felt caught in my reflection. James looked at me worriedly. Let's go, he said. I think you'll like the room, he said. I tried to set it up so that you'll be comfortable. The room was a wide suite with tall windows. We could see the skyline rising above the river. James closed the door, and we sat on the floor, holding hands, staring at one another. He looked thin, and his hair was falling over his eyes. What do you want to do? He sounded uncertain, and his voice shook. I just want to be here, I said. I listened to the sound of rain on the windows, the sounds of the silent hotel. What do you want to do when we go back home? I asked. James smiled, a hesitant smile. Home. That sounds nice. Home was an idea. The future was an idea. I couldn't think of the past. There were too many lifetimes to remember. The future felt safe. I was with James. It would be okay. We talked carefully about the future, small details. I told him that I had missed hot drinks, and he laughed as he made me a cup of tea. My hands curled around the porcelain mug. I had missed the feel of porcelain in my hands. We didn't talk about what had happened the past few days. We avoided it. It hung in the air heavily. It was like waking up from a dream. I showed James my foam slippers proudly. These were my favorite possession. But he looked sad and upset, so I set them aside. I lay in the hotel bed and reveled in the soft sheets, the feel of the pillow cool against my cheek. We feasted on sushi, spicy Korean stew, oysters, ice cream, mochi. I had lost 15 pounds since being admitted. James set up the food in a single line on the coffee table, like he had in the hospital. We sat across from one another, like reflections. It's like a mirror, I said, and James looked at me sharply. Cato is at my parents' house, James said. I hadn't asked where Cato was, but James pretended that he hadn't noticed. I learned that my parents were at my in-laws' house as well, taking care of Cato. They had canceled the 100-day celebration party and had a quiet gathering at home. James showed me the photos of Cato surrounded by pale blue streamers and a small plate of rice cakes, and I stared at them without recognition. On the first night, there was a heavy snowfall. We walked outside in the quiet white evening, holding a red umbrella. We watched our feet sink deeply into the snow, leaving footprints of white. The highways were still, and the only sound was of the snow falling. I thought of the ward and tried to imagine seeing the snow from the window in the television room. I was free now. I breathed the air deeply, taking in the cold, taking in the fullness of the snow, and I felt, for the first time in a long time, peace. My parents brought Cato to the hotel on the second day. My mother looked thinner, more fragile. Her eyes met mine, and I could see a sliver of hurt there that I didn't know if I could repair. My father stood gruffly in his coat and nodded. He was holding Cato, who was curled in his arms. His eyes looked at me, unexpected. As I thought, I didn't recognize Cato. He looked like a stranger. I searched myself for some emotion, but I couldn't find any. "Don't you want to hold him?" my mother asked. I forced myself to nod. He felt heavy, like an unfamiliar weight. I tried to remember how to hold him, but he was much bigger than I remembered. He didn't seem comfortable. He didn't look at my face. He just looked over my shoulder, struggling back and forth. He didn't look like the photos. His face was different, and his eyes that used to be devil's eyes looked at me innocently. His hair looked strange. "His hair started falling out," James said. I looked at Cato. "My son," I reminded myself, and I felt nothing. We were separate beings, truly separated. It was like he had been cut from me again. I looked into the distance, outside the window, where I saw the outlines of New York City and the fog from the river. My father quietly took him back from me, and I saw my parents look at each other with concern. I sat on the bed and stared out the window, while my father paced with Cato in his arms. Cato started to cry, and my mother handed my father a bottle. "Oh," James said apologetically. "He's on a bottle now, but he seems to like it." I shrugged. "All that struggle," I thought dully. "How are you?" my mother asked. She touched my hand gently. She looked like she was about to cry. "Did you eat well?" I smiled at the typical Korean greeting. I nodded. "I'm fine," I said. My parents left quietly, promising to visit the next day. "Get some rest," they said. They didn't meet my eyes when they left. James and I walked along the harbor front. The city shone like glass, glittering bright against the metal of the sky. We walked side by side, hands clasped, James feeling steady and grounded against me. It felt like we were existing separately from the rest of the world, except that sometimes James had to be on the phone to the insurance companies to discuss our flight and my medical bills. "I don't want you to worry about this," he said, and he would carefully shut the door behind him and speak so that I couldn't hear. He told me later that he had been on the phone with insurance companies for hours, trying to find out if my hospital stay would be covered. "We need to get back to the UK," James said. "I miss the NHS. My eyesight was still blurry, and I couldn't read. I showed James my notebook. "Do you want to read it?" I asked. "Later," he said. "I'll read it later when we get home." The days passed by slowly. We would wake and walk along the harbor front, trudging through the snow. We would pick up breakfast and eat on the floor of the hotel room, talking over hot cups of coffee and buttered bagels. My parents would come with Cato and stay for a while. I would hold Cato sometimes. He didn't seem to be getting used to me, but I would touch his face and the softness of his hair. It was a Tuesday morning when we checked out of the hotel, and our flight was that evening. I had to wonder what the hotel staff thought, my parents walking in and out with a baby, James and I taking long walks around the harbor. But the receptionist looked bored. Perhaps our actions didn't seem out of the ordinary. I thought I caught a glimpse of a demon's eyes from her, and my breath caught in my throat. "We're going to go to my parents' house," James said. "Is that all right?" "Yes," I said. I wanted to see it before I left. As we pulled into the neighborhood subdivision, it didn't feel menacing, just familiar. It was just a house. James's father was waiting outside for our car. He embraced me, laughing as we slipped in the snow. I took a deep breath as we walked up to the door. James's mother embraced me fiercely. She was crying. She stared at me and asked me if I was all right. I nodded. "Have you been eating well?" she asked. I smiled. My mother-in-law had prepared tables of food. "I wasn't sure what you'd want to eat," she said. She seemed shy, and sometimes she had trouble meeting my eyes. My parents were upstairs, and they came down with Cato. My mother hugged me, while my father patted me awkwardly on the shoulder. "We're going to leave," my mother said. They were preparing for the drive home. "Take care of yourself," she said. It was an abrupt goodbye, and I stood by the glass door to wave as they drove away. I stayed on the couch, quietly sitting with a cup of tea, while Cato slept on a mattress next to me. James's parents were talking softly to each other in the kitchen, while James was upstairs on the phone with the insurance companies again. I felt numb. I couldn't feel relief or joy. I was out. I was free. I should be feeling light, but instead I felt weighted and dull, like I was in a tank of water. James's parents drove us to the airport, and when we left for the departures terminal, I turned to see them, waving slowly, gravely at us, worry imprinted on their faces. On the flight back to London, I looked out the window, to the clouds, to the curve of moon. The beginning of the trip seemed so long ago. Time no longer felt linear to me. I had too many repeating moments, too many gaps. Back in London, I let James take care of Cato, while I lay in bed and read my notebook, looked over the scraps of paper, the frenzied notes, the pages of lions, unicorns, and bears, colored in marker. My memories felt sharp, raised like a scar. I still had to take my medication, 3 pills that looked small in my palm, an antipsychotic that made my brain feel numb and my hands shake, a pill that countered the side effects of the antipsychotic, and a sedative that helped me sleep at night. Eventually, James and I would talk about those days. James would tell me that he knew something was wrong when I asked to leave his parents' house, but he wasn't sure what it was. He told me that Teddy also realized something was wrong during our phone call. I learned that he and James decided that they would try to get me to calm down and to sleep. However, by the time James took me to the hospital, I was manic, stripping my clothes and screaming in the emergency waiting room. James told me the hardest moment was watching me as I was fighting with the nurses while they clamped me in restraints. James's memory of those days in the hospital was that I was frantic, in constant motion, talking one moment about Greek and Norse gods and screaming the next. Sometimes he was able to distract me by asking me about the past or by playing question games, but sometimes he wasn't able to, and I would address the ceiling and talk so quickly I would bite my tongue. The only way that he could get me to eat was to sit in front of me and have me imitate him. He said that I was obsessed with the date written on the number board above my bed. Eventually, he said, they erased it. Sometimes I referred to myself as Beatrice, as James, as Cato. Sometimes I thought I was a child and drew scribbled pictures like a preschooler, and other times I thought I was an old woman. He said there were times I seemed lucid, and that those moments were the hardest. He could see the terror and confusion in my eyes. He said that he could get me to smile by dancing or reminiscing about the past. But no matter what he did, he couldn't get me to sleep. It was on the third day that James called my parents to come up from Virginia. James said the conversation was confused. "You have to come now," he had said. Had there been an accident? No. Was I unwell? Yes. And no, not physically. "I don't understand," my mother had said. "It's an emergency," James had said. "It's an emergency. Cat is really sick. Mentally sick." They had driven up to New Jersey and gone straight to the hospital. When they came in, I didn't recognize them. I stayed lying in bed and chattered to the ceiling, making shadow animals with my hands. They stayed with me while James went home to sleep. Teddy said that he couldn't come. He had too many things going on in Seattle. James's eyes narrowed when he told me this. I learned that they had argued about it. "My being there won't help her get better," Teddy had said. He was calm, measured. "This is temporary. She is going to get better." James couldn't understand how he had seemed so unconcerned, so unfazed. "He knows me," I said. I understood. It wouldn't have helped to have Teddy there, and I didn't know how to explain to James that Teddy had always been there, a voice on the phone, talking me calmly through each nightmare. James said that I had refused to talk to my mother. We would argue. She had to spend most of the time standing in the hallway. Her presence agitated me. However, my father would listen to my raving quietly. He would sit by my bedside and hold my hand, nodding and saying he understood. He would ask questions about Dante's Inferno and the Greek mythologies. James told me that the decision was made by the hospital team that I needed to be admitted to an involuntary ward. He told me that when they transferred me, I was singing loudly in French. The song I was singing was Edith Piaf's Non, je ne regrette rien. He had played it for my parents that night, and my father wept. I learned from James that the animal pound I thought I was in when I reached my most manic state was actually the high security area of the psych ward, and the animals were the security guards. James had watched as I screamed and fought and was restrained by the guards. He was shouting too, but they kicked him out of the room. He said that as he sat in the waiting room, listening to my screams, a man asked him if he believed in God. James said no. The man said, "Well, now is the time to start. I will say a prayer for your wife." I like to think that that man was a guardian. James said that while I was in the room, fighting and screaming, I stripped off my clothes and urinated on the floor. I was eventually sedated, and for the first time in days, I was able to sleep. He told me that the happiest moment for him was when Teddy called to tell him that I had called, that I had sounded like myself. He told me that he had made two other visits, ones that I don't remember. He said that I had seemed agitated, fidgety, and had spent most of the time drawing pictures on pieces of paper. He said that one of the workers had braided my hair, and it had made him feel reassured that I was being taken care of. James and I talked about those days until it didn't frighten us anymore. My sense of what was real and not real was blurred, but slowly I was able to reconstruct what was reality and what was my psychosis. Once my eyesight became better, I read obsessively about postpartum psychosis. I joined a forum of women who had experienced it. I read about the fear, the isolation. I learned that for most women, postpartum psychosis occurs a day or two after the birth. It was unusual for it to occur when the baby was already a few months old. My official diagnosis was stress-induced postpartum psychosis. While the reasons for postpartum psychosis aren't fully understood, the symptoms are usually similar: paranoia, racing thoughts, delusions, and inability to sleep. I heard from women who had been convinced their baby was a demon or thought their baby was going to catch fire. There was a woman who had forgotten she had had a baby, and she wept every time she discovered her C-section scar, and another who was convinced that her baby was not her own. One thing that was shared by all these women was a feeling of separation from their child, and I could sense from the forums that there was a deep sense of shame from the women who had been unwell. I read news stories, sensationalized ones, and my breath caught when I read of a woman who jumped off a bridge with her newborn baby. I learned that if we had been in the UK, I would have been admitted to a mother-baby unit and not as a regular psych patient as I was in the US. I learned that the medication I had been prescribed, haloperidol, would have been unusual in the UK, as it is considered to be extreme. The treatment in the UK is focused on keeping mother and baby as close to one another as possible in order to minimize emotional separation. In the UK, I would not have been separated from Cato. When I read this, I felt angry. The separation had been unnecessary. The rules felt so trivial and arbitrary, and they had such an impact on our lives. I had come back a stranger, and the distance I felt from Cato wasn't something I could grieve. It went beyond loss. It was a severance, a removal that was complete. I learned that we had been unlucky to avoid any further separation. The state had threatened to call child services because I was potentially unfit to care for Cato. James had been worried that we wouldn't have been able to come home, lost in a bureaucratic nightmare. A part of me was also angry when I found out that the ostensible reason given for why we canceled the 100-day celebration was my exhaustion. Did the family really believe that? I wondered. But it wasn't for me to contradict. People wouldn't understand, my mother and mother-in-law both said to me on separate occasions. I understood. And so I kept quiet and tried to smile when people asked about my exhaustion and whether I had had enough rest. In London, I was assigned a team to oversee my recovery. They were called the Mental Health Crisis Team. James and I met with a perinatal psychiatrist who listened quietly to what had happened. I remember that I told her the story in the past tense as though it was now behind us. We were optimistic, buoyant even. I asked her about coming off my medication, but she told me that we needed to wait. I think she knew that there was still more to come. A few weeks after our meeting, I fell into a deep depression. It is a common occurrence after postpartum psychosis and taking haloperidol antipsychotic medication. It seemed instantaneous, like the descent of darkness under an ocean, immediate and complete, without any memory of the light that had been there before. I felt stripped of any life force. I didn't have the strength to lift a spoon. When I sat up, my entire body ached. I had never known anything like this. I couldn't even form a smile. It hurt my face too much. I spent my time in bed, each day stretched out in moments, while I stared at the blankness of the ceiling. I spent the hours trying to will myself to breathe, trying to will myself to stand up, and not being able to. I felt like I was at the edge of something, something that would swallow me whole. I could sense a vastness I didn't understand. Sometimes I could feel its quiet approach, and I thought I was going to be lost, and I didn't know what to do. In those moments, I would close my eyes and count, and try to stay. The crisis team visited me every morning at my flat to check in. I forced myself to get out of bed when I heard the bell ring. Sometimes I'd be able to brush my hair, smooth my clothes. Most days I couldn't. I sat very still, a presence on a chair. I was aware I had a body, but I couldn't be sure that I existed. "How are you feeling today?" they would ask me. I would try to form words, to find the breath behind my voice, but most of the time I would not be able to answer. They would look at my face and say, "You will get better," and they would smile. "This will pass." And I tried to believe them, in the promise in their smiles. They told me to make lists, goals for each day, things to do. There were pages of lists in my shaky handwriting. Each task seemed insurmountable. Get out of bed. Make a cup of tea. Play the piano. Make a phone call. Hug Cato. Their visits each morning only lasted a few minutes, but those minutes were precious, a promise of light in what felt like an abyss. I felt grateful for each task they gave me, and I would mark them off my list, my hands shaking as I tried to hold a pen. There were some days when I felt the promise of light for a longer moment, but then it would be gone, and I would return to looking at the vastness. I felt like I was slowly drowning. I was reaching for emotion, but there was only a silent desperation, and it felt absolute and unending. As I lay in bed, I often wondered about the other residents in the ward. I would think of Tamira. Had she had her baby? I wondered about Emma and what happened to her after we had all left her behind. Did Ali finally get released? And Will, was he homeless? Was he on the streets? And Darren, with a gentle voice, would he be okay? I wondered about all of their stories, interrupted. I had only caught a glimpse of their lives. My mother came to London to visit every few months. While I lay in bed, she would stroke my hair, which had grown long and brittle, and worry over the marks on my skin. She would massage my legs and arms the way Korean grandmothers do, trying to stimulate blood flow. "It'll be good for you," she said. She told me stories and scolded me like the old times, chattering as she cooked my favorite dishes and tried to coax me into eating. I knew that I had caused her pain, but I had a deeper understanding of her love. I had a sense that after my psychosis, she had let me go. "Spend time with James," she would say. And she would smile as I would finally sit up from bed to walk with James to the park. "It's hard," she said, when I couldn't swallow a spoonful of the soup she had made for me. "It's hard not to be able to make your child happy." And she would look at me with an expression that I didn't fully understand. "When you are a baby, when you were a child, all you needed was me to make you happy." "You will understand." It was unspoken, but the words were there. Love flows down. My father did not visit. He faded back into absence. However, I learned from James that my father had come with him to every meeting at the ward. that my father would play Satie on the piano in the lobby, and they would listen to the notes echo in the hall. James told me that as they waited for the doctors, they would talk about mathematics, about Kentucky, about my childhood. I wasn't kind to her, my father had said. James said that my father knew I was back to normal on their last visit to the ward because I didn't talk to him. It's when he drew number man for me. Perhaps he knew that we were back to the way things were. When I heard that, I didn't know what to feel. I knew that I felt some of the regret I had seen on his face as he left the ward that day. I thought about talking to him, but I didn't know what I would say. Words seemed inadequate, and perhaps he already knew. Teddy would call me every day on the phone to check in. He spoke to me gently. Sometimes he would ask after Cato, but mostly he would ask after me. I had told him what my father had said to James, and Teddy had given a short laugh of disbelief. I know, I had said. Thinking of Teddy made me feel wistful, like I wasn't sure if I was thinking of a version of a boy who no longer existed. But I don't think that's true. He will always be my foxhole buddy. And James, he was patient with me as I waited to come back to myself. He would walk slowly with me, hand in hand, through the park under the fading sun, and I would try to remember what it felt like to feel something, anything. I don't know if psychosis brought us closer together. I hope that it did. What I do know is that it changed something profoundly in James. The eternal optimist that I knew and loved now has a darkness in him, something that casts a deep shadow. I was upset when he packed an emergency hospital bag in case I had another episode. I watched him lay out supplies on the bed, a phone charger, spare bottles for Cato. It made me nervous, I said. It was unnecessary. But he shook his head. He wouldn't be caught off guard again. He had been shaken. His certainty, his sense of control had been lost. James said there was a time while we were at the hospital when he thought maybe I wouldn't get better and that this was going to be our reality. And he didn't know what to do except to wait. He had been sitting in the hallway outside my hospital room, trying to pause, to understand what was happening, when Lane had put a hand on his shoulder. He told James he had been watching us dance. He was just getting over a breakup, he said in a confiding tone, and James laughed despite himself. Love problems. It's nice you're here, Lane had said. Most people leave. They can't handle it. Sometimes I would think about that pull I had, the thought that I had to restart, to exit. It would frighten me and leave me feeling hollow, like I was standing over a precipice or looking at the expanse of the ocean. It was love that saved me. I was sure of that. My love for James, my refusal to leave him behind. I had thought that was my sacrifice, but in actuality, it was what had saved me from myself. My depression would last for several months, and each day I struggled to come back to the surface, to myself. My interaction with Cato was a few minutes each day at most. I would hold him in the mornings while James got ready to go to work. Holding Cato felt wrong, unnatural, even painful. I would count the seconds until I could get away with giving him back. It was May when I was able to move my body without effort. I no longer felt like I was underwater. I was becoming myself again. I could remember glimmers of emotion, like joy or hope, but I couldn't remember what it felt like to love Cato. He was still distant from me. I had thought that in becoming myself, I would find my son, too. I thought of my love for Cato as being buried within me. Surely, being a mother was something that had been imprinted on me. It would be waiting for me. But when I looked at Cato, he could have been anyone's baby. The curve of his hands, the lines of his face, they were unfamiliar. He no longer belonged to me. I didn't understand how a relationship could be so fragile. Those months of carrying him in my body, the hours when he had slept in my arms, that fierce possessiveness, how could it be erased? The only way I could understand it was that it was an intention. Perhaps I had sent him away from me, an instinct to protect him from a mother who couldn't be trusted. Perhaps, I thought, it was an act of love. The thought didn't comfort me. When I looked at Cato, it was a reminder of what I had lost, that whatever connection there had been was gone, and it seemed would never come back. I thought I should want to mourn, but I didn't feel any longing for him either. It made me feel like a hollow shell. I would stare at Cato, and he would stare back at me, at his mother, a mother who couldn't smile or hug him. I wondered if he could sense it, the stranger who had taken his mother's place. So I went through the motions. I reminded myself to reach for him, to smooth his hair when it fell across his face, to stroke his cheek. I practiced smiling at him, thinking this is what a mother would do. I wondered if there was a way to build love, and if there was, did that mean it was manufactured, less real? I took my medication faithfully. I counted the colorful pills in my palm each week, lining them up in the pill box James had ordered for me. I would stay on the antipsychotic and antidepressant for a year. I watched my body change from the medication until it no longer felt like my own. The doctors adjusted the dosages, and I felt relieved when they started the process of taking me off them completely. And to Cato, I asked him to wait for me to come back. And while I waited, I looked for joy in the moments with him. I listened to his laughter. I clapped when he learned to take his first steps. And I held his hand when it was outstretched for mine. I looked for the suspended moments, the ones that I needed to capture. And then one day, an ordinary day, as I was holding him, I remembered him. His smile, the feel of his breath against my arm, the warmth of sun against our cheeks, the weight of his body against my own. And I was a mother again. Acknowledgements. I want to thank my agent, Sophie Lambert, for her wisdom and steady guidance. Thank you for taking a chance on me and for being the most amazing champion for this book. Thank you for making this dream come true. Thank you to Molly Atlas for her brilliance and for shepherding this book in the U.S. Thank you to Katie Greenstreet. I'm so lucky to have you on my side. Thank you to Kate Burton, Alexander Cochran, Matilda Aris, and to everyone at CNW Agency. Thank you to Kelly Oden and the team at ICM. I am so grateful to my wonderful editors, Angelique Tran Van Sang and Caroline Zanken. Thank you for your support and guidance through this process. I'm so inspired by your intelligence and passion, and I really can't believe how lucky I am. Thank you to Alexa von Hirschberg for your faith in this book. Many thanks to Carrie Cullen and the teams at Holt and Bloomsbury for their care. Thank you to my early readers, Emma Bailey, an inspirational human woman generous with her genius, Betty Ho for reading countless drafts and giving incisive advice, Emma Claire Sweeney for being a guiding hand as always. Thank you also to Eileen Park, Arzu Tazen, Jonathan Ruppin, Georgina Simmons. I am indebted to our friends who supported us during my recovery. Marta Vergnano, Regina Aberin Tran, Susan Zeng, Ariane Ling, Eileen Sun, Janet Lau, Anita Lin, Erwin Tran, Enrico Berardo. I cherish you all. Thank you to Jane De La Pena for the help you gave to our family. Special thanks to Tom Ward and his Boeuf Bourguignon. It made it in the book somehow. I am so thankful to Johnny Geller for your mentorship and counsel. Thank you to my pod, Lucy Morris, Lucia Walker, Abby Greaves, Jess Whitlam Cooper, and of course, EB2, for your thoughtfulness and for sending brightness when I needed it most. I would like to thank the many healthcare professionals who took care of us. That this is something you do each day for anyone who passes your doors is awe-inspiring. Thank you to the teams at the hospital and medical center. Every kind word and caring action made a lasting impression. Special thanks to Namandi for being such a light, and to Lane for your kindness. I am very grateful to Dr. Sarah Taha and the mental health crisis team for being a lifeline. Thank you to Dr. Anthony Jolly, Dr. Anna Solly, and Sharon Judd, and the first mental health team for your expertise and care. I am thankful to the writing teachers I've had over the years for sharing their expertise and love of the craft. I've never forgotten the lessons and encouragement you gave me. Judy Turner, Melanie Cameron, Olivia Birdsall, Pat Hoy, Bonnie Friedman. Thank you to the Choi family, Paul, Sarah, Bill, Lori, and especially Abanim and Amanim for your love and support. Thank you to my family, Amma, Appa, and Teddy, for being my foundation and for helping me come back to myself. Thank you also to Amma for being the one to show me how to tell a story. Finally, to James, you were and are my anchor. Thank you for always being there, for dancing with me even in the hospital, and for always making me feel safe in your love. Thank you to you and Cato for your patience and love. This has been our journey.
We hope you've enjoyed Inferno, a Macmillan audio production from Henry Holt & Company. Production supervised by Catherine Carroll. Text copyright 2020 by Catherine Cho. Production copyright 2020 by Bloomsbury Publishing PLC. All rights reserved.